She wasn't really looking. She instead let Wayne tow her to relative cover beside a building, then both of them began craning to search the skyline for the sniper. Waxillium took to the air with a dropped coin, a dark rush of twisting mistcoat tassels. At times like this he looked more primal, like one of the ancient mistborn from the legends. Not a creature of law, but a sliver of the night itself come to collect its due.
"Oh, hell,"
Wayne said, nodding toward Marks. The body slumped in the middle of the road and now had a prominent wooden shaft sticking out of it.
"Arrow?"
Marcy asked.
"Crossbow bolt," Wayne said. "Haven't seen one of those in years. You really only want them for fighting allomancers."
He looked up. Above, Waxillium gave chase, soaring toward the top of one of the buildings.
"Stay here,"
Wayne said, then dashed off down an alleyway.
"Wait,"
Marcy said, raising a hand. But he was gone.
"Those two,"
she thought in annoyance. Well, obviously someone didn't want Marks to be captured and spill what he knew. Perhaps she could learn something from the crossbow bolt or the corpse itself. She knelt down beside the body, checking first to make certain he was dead, hoping perhaps that the crossbow bolt had not finished the job. He was dead, unfortunately. The bolt was firmly lodged in the head. Who knew that a crossbow could penetrate a skull like that? Marcy shook her head, reaching into her handbag to get her notepad and do a write-up of the position the body had fallen in.
"You know," she thought, "the assassin is lucky. They were gone so fast, they couldn't have known that they dealt a killing blow. If I were looking to make sure Marks was finished off, I'd certainly..."
She heard something click behind her.
"Double back and check."
Marcy turned slowly to find a ragged-looking man leaving an alleyway holding a crossbow. He inspected her with dark eyes. The next part happened quickly. Before Marcy had time to take a step, the man rushed her. He fired the crossbow over his shoulder, causing a Wayne-like yelp to come out of the alleyway, then grabbed Marcy by the shoulder as she tried to run. He whipped her about, raising something cold to her neck. A glass dagger. Waxillium dropped to the ground in front of him, mistcoat unfurling around him. The two stared at each other, a coin in Waxillium's right hand. He rubbed it with his thumb.
"Remember your hostage training, woman?"
Marcy thought.
"Most men take a hostage out of desperation."
Could she use her allomancy? She could slow time around her, speeding it up for everyone outside her speed bubble. The opposite of what Wayne could do. But she hadn't swallowed any cadmium.
Stupid!
A mistake the other two would never make. She needed to stop being embarrassed with her powers, weak though they were. She'd used them effectively on more than one occasion. The man breathed in and out raggedly, his head right next to hers. She could feel the stubble of his chin and cheek against her skin.
"Men who take hostages don't want to kill," she thought. "This isn't part of the plan. You can talk him down, speak comforting words, seek common ground and build upon it."
She didn't do any of that. Instead, she whipped her hand out of her handbag, gripping the small single-shot pistol she kept inside. Before even considering what she was doing, she pressed the barrel against the man's chin, pulled the trigger, and blew the bottom of his head up out of the top. 4. Wax lowered his hand, looking at the new corpse beside Marcy. Her shot had taken off a big chunk of the face. Identifying the man would be near impossible. It would have been anyway. Suit's minions were notoriously difficult to trace.
"Don't worry about that right now," he thought, taking out a handkerchief.
He walked over and held it up to Marcy, who stood with wide eyes, blood and bits of flesh sprayed across her face. She stared straight ahead and did not look down. She'd dropped the pistol.
"That was..."
she said, eyes ahead.
"That was..."
She took a deep breath.
"That was unexpected of me, wasn't it?"
"You did well," Wax said. "People assume a captive to be in their power. Often the best way to escape is by fighting back."
"What?"
Marcy said, finally taking the handkerchief.
"You discharged a pistol right beside your head," Wax said. "You're going to have trouble hearing. Rusts. You've probably done some permanent damage to your ear. Hopefully it won't be too bad."
"What?"
Wax gestured toward her face, and she looked at the handkerchief as if seeing it for the first time. She blinked, then glanced down. She looked away from the corpse immediately and began wiping at her face. Wayne, grumbling, staggered out of the alleyway, a new hole in his clothing at the shoulder and a crossbow bolt in his hand.
"So much for interrogating him," Marcy said with a grimace.
"It's all right," Wax said. "Living was more important."
"What?"
He smiled at her reassuringly as Wayne waved to some other constables who had finally arrived on the scene and were making their way into the slums.
"Why does this keep happening to me?" Marcy asked. "Yes, I know I won't be able to hear your reply, but this is, what, the third time someone has tried to use me as a hostage? Do I exude indefensibility or something?"
"Yes, you do," Wax thought, though he didn't say it. "That's a good thing. It makes them underestimate you." Marcy was a strong person. She thought clearly in times of stress. She did what needed to be done, even if it was unpleasant. However, she was also very keen on dressing nicely and making herself up. Lessie would have had none of that. The only times Wax had seen her in a dress were when they'd made the occasional trip to Covingtar to visit the Pathian Gardens there. He smiled, remembering a time she'd actually worn trousers under the dress.
"Lord Ladrian!"
Constable Reddy trotted over, wearing the uniform of a captain in the constabulary. The lean man had a neatly clipped, drooping mustache.
"Ready?" Wax said, nodding to him.
"Is Aradel here?"
"The Constable General is engaged in another investigation, my lord,"
Reddy said with a crisp tone. Why did Wax always want to smack this man after talking to him? He was never insulting, always impeccably proper. Maybe that was reason enough. Wax pointed toward the buildings.
"Well, if you'd kindly have your men secure the area, we should probably question those nearby and see if, by some miracle, we can discover the identity of the man Lady Combs just killed."
Reddy saluted, though it wasn't technically necessary. Wax had a special deputized forbearance in the constabulary, allowing him to do things like, well, jump through the city armed and firing. But he wasn't in their command structure. The other constables moved to do as he requested anyway. As he glanced at the marksman, Wax forcibly kept his anger in check. At this rate, he would never track down his Uncle Ed Warren. Wax had only the slightest hint of what the man was trying to accomplish.
"It can make anyone into an allomancer, you see. If we don't use it, someone else will."
Words from the book Iron Eyes had given him.
"Excellent work, my lord,"
Reddy said in a calm voice, nodding to the fallen marksman. The clothing was distinctive.
"Another miscreant dealt with, and with your customary efficiency."
Wax said nothing. Today's excellent work was just another dead end.
"Hey, look,"
Wayne said nearby.
"I think I found one of their fellow's teeth. That's good luck, ain't it?"
Marcy looked woozy, settling down on a nearby set of steps. Wax was tempted to go comfort her, but would she interpret it the wrong way? He didn't want to lead her on.
"My lord, could we talk?"
Reddy said, as more constables flooded the area.
"I mentioned the Constable General and another case. I was actually already on my way to find you when we heard of your chase here."
Wax turned to him, immediately alert.
"What has happened?"
Reddy grimaced, showing uncharacteristic emotion.
"It's bad, my lord,"
he said more softly.
"Politics is involved."
"Then suit might be involved as well. Tell me more."
"Well, it's connected to the governor, my lord. His brother, you see, was hosting an auction last night. And, well, you should see for yourself."
Marcy didn't miss Waxillium grabbing Wayne by the shoulder and pointing toward a waiting constabulary carriage. He didn't come for her. How long would it be before that damnable man was willing to accept her, if not as an equal, a colleague? Frustrated, she made toward the carriage. Unfortunately, she ran into Captain Reddy on the way. He spoke, and she had to strain her ringing ears, and guess a little, to figure out what he was saying.
"Constable Combs, you are out of uniform.
"Yes, sir," she said. "It is my day off, sir."
"Yet here you are," he said, hands clasped behind his back. "How is it that you find your way consistently into situations like this, despite explicitly being told that it is not your assignment, as you are not a field constable?"
"Pure happenstance, I'm sure, sir," Marcy said.
He gave her a sneer at that. Funny. He usually saved those for Waxillium when the man wasn't looking. He said something she couldn't make out, then nodded toward the motor car she'd brought, which was technically constabulary property, though she'd been told to become proficient in driving motor cars and report on their effectiveness to the Constable General. He wanted to test them as replacements for horse-drawn carriages.
"Sir," she said.
"You've obviously been through a great deal this day, Constable," Reddy said more loudly. "Don't argue with me on this. Head home, clean up, and report for duty tomorrow."
"Sir,"
Marcy said,
"I'd like to brief Captain Aradel on my pursuit of the marksman and his subsequent demise before the details become fuzzy. He will be interested, as he's followed this case personally."
She stared Reddy in the eyes. He outranked her, yes, but he wasn't her boss. Aradel was that to both of them.
"The Constable General," Reddy said, with some obvious reluctance, "is away from the offices at the moment."
"Well, then I'll report to him and let him dismiss me, sir," Marcy said. "If that is his wish."
Reddy ground his teeth and started to say something, but a call from one of the other constables diverted him. He waved toward the motor car, and Marcy took it as dismissal to do as she'd said. So when the carriage with Waxillium pulled away, she followed in the motor car. By the time the trip had ended, at a fashionable mansion overlooking the city's hub, she had started to recover. She was still feeling shaken, though she hoped she didn't show it, and she could hear with her left ear, if not on the other side, where she'd fired the gun. As she climbed out of the motor car, she found herself wiping her cheek again with her handkerchief, though she had long since cleaned off the blood. Her dress had been thoroughly ruined. She grabbed her constable's coat from the back of the motor car and threw it over the top to hide the stains, then rushed over to join Waxillium and the others as they descended from the carriage.
"Only one other constabulary carriage," she noted, inspecting the drive.
Whatever had happened here, Aradel didn't want to make a big show of it. As Waxillium walked up toward the front, he glanced about and found her, then waved her over to him.
"Do you know what this might be about?"
he asked her quietly, as Reddy and several other constables conferred near the carriage.
"No,"
Marcy said.
"They didn't brief you?"
Waxillium shook his head. He glanced down at her bloodied dress, which peeked out underneath the sturdy brown jacket. He made no comment, however, instead striding up the steps, tailed by Wayne. Two constables, a man and a woman, guarded the door into the mansion. They saluted as Reddy caught up to Waxillium, pointedly ignoring Marcy, and led the way in through the doors.
"We've tried to keep this very tightly controlled," Reddy said, "but word will get out, with Lord Winsting involved. Rusts, this is going to be a nightmare."
"The governor's brother?"
Marcy asked.
"What happened here?"
Reddy pointed up a set of steps.
"We should find Constable General Aradel in the grand ballroom. I warn you, this is not a sight for delicate stomachs."
He glanced at Marcy. She raised an eyebrow.
"Not an hour ago I had a man's head literally explode all over me, Captain. I believe I will be fine."
Reddy said nothing further, leading the way up the steps. She noticed Wayne pocketing a small decorative cigar box they passed. Citizen Magistrate's brand, replacing it with a bruised apple. She'd have to see that he swapped the cigar box back at some point. The ballroom upstairs was littered with bodies. Marcy and Waxillium stopped in the doorway, looking in at the chaos. The dead men and women wore fine clothes, sleek ball gowns or tight black suits. Hats lay tumbled from heads, the fine tan carpet stained red in wide patches around the fallen. It was as if someone had tossed a basket of eggs into the air and let them fall, their insides seeping out all over the floor. Claude Aradel, Constable General of the 4th Octant, picked through the scene. In many ways, he didn't look like a constable should. His rectangular face had a few days' worth of red stubble on it. He shaved when the mood struck him. His leathery skin, furrowed with wrinkles, attested to days spent in the field, not behind a desk. He was probably pushing 60 at this point, though he wouldn't divulge his true age, and even the Octant records had a question mark next to his birth date. What was certain was that Aradel didn't have a drop of noble blood in him. He'd left the constabulary about 10 years ago, giving no official reason for his departure. Rumor was he'd hit the silent ceiling on promotions a man could get without being noble. A lot could change in 10 years, though, and when Breton had retired, soon after the execution of Miles' 100 lives, almost a year ago, the hunt for a new Constable General had landed on Aradel. He'd come out of retirement to accept the position.
"Adrian," he said, looking up from a corpse. "Good, you're here."
He crossed the room and gave a glance to Marcy, who saluted. He didn't dismiss her.
"Aw," Wayne said, peeking in. "The fun is already over."
Waxillium stepped into the room, taking Aradel's proffered hand. "That's Chip Erichel, isn't it?" Waxillium asked, nodding to the nearest corpse. "Thought to run smuggling in the Third Octant?"
"Yes,"
Aradel said.
"And Isabelline Frelia," Marcy said. "Rusts, we have a file on her as tall as Wayne, but the prosecutors have never been able to charge her."
"7 of these bodies belong to people of equivalent notoriety,"
Aradel said, pointing to several corpses among the fallen.
"Most from crime syndicates, though a few were members of noble houses with dubious reputations. The rest were high-ranking representatives from other important factions. We have near 30 notable stiffs, along with a handful of guards each."
"That's half of the city's criminal elite," Waxillium said softly, crouching down beside a body. "At least."
"All people we've never been able to touch," Aradel said. "Not for lack of trying, mind you."
"So why is everyone so grim?" Wayne asked. "We should be throwing a bloomin' party, shouldn't we? Someone went and did our work for us. We can take the month off."
Marcy shook her head.
"A violent change in power in the underworld can be dangerous, Wayne. This was a hit of huge ambition, someone eliminating rivals wholesale."
Aradel glanced at her, then nodded in agreement. She felt a surge of satisfaction. The Constable General was the one who had hired her, picking her application out of a dozen others. Every other person in the pile had had years of constable experience. Instead, he'd chosen a recently graduated law student. He saw something promising in her, obviously, and she intended to prove him right.
"I can't fathom someone doing this," Waxillium said. "Toppling so many of the city's underworld powers at once won't favor the perpetrators. That's a myth from penny novels. Murders on this scale will just draw attention and unify opposition from every other surviving gang and faction as soon as word gets out."
"Unless it was done by an outsider," Marcy said. "An uncertain element from the start. Someone who stands to gain if the entire system crumbles."
Aradel grunted, and Waxillium nodded in agreement.
"But how?" Waxillium whispered. "How did someone achieve this? Surely their security must have rivaled any in the city."
He began moving about, pacing off distances, looking at certain bodies, then at others, whispering to himself as he periodically knelt down.
"Reddy said that the governor's brother was involved, sir?" Marcy asked Aradel.
"Lord Winsting Innate."
Lord Winsting, head of House Innate. He had a vote in the Ellendel Senate, a position he gained once his brother was elevated to governor. He had been corrupt. Marcy and the rest of the constables knew it. In retrospect, she wasn't surprised to find him in the middle of something like this. The thing was, Winsting had always seemed a small catch to Marcy. The governor, however... Well, perhaps that hidden file on her desk, full of hints, guesses, and clues, would finally be relevant.
"Winsting?" she asked Aradel. "Is he..."
"Dead?" Aradel asked. "Yes, Constable Combs. From the invitations we found, he initiated this meeting under the guise of an auction. We located his corpse in a safe room in the basement."
This drew Waxillium's attention. He stood up, looking directly at them, then muttered something to himself, and paced off another body. What was he searching for? Wayne wandered over to Maracy and Aradel. He took a swig from a silver flask engraved with someone else's initials. Maracy pointedly did not ask him which of the dead he'd taken it from.
"So," he said, "our little house leader was friendly with criminals, was he?"
"We've long suspected he was crooked," Aradel said. "The people love his family, though, and his brother went to great lengths to keep Winsting's previous lapses out of the limelight."
"You're right, Aradel," Waxelium said from across the room. "This will be bad."
"I don't know," Wayne said. "Maybe he didn't know these folks were all trouble."
"Doubtful," Maracy said. "And even if it were true, it wouldn't matter. Once the broadsheets get a hold of this, the governor's sibling, dead in a house full of known criminals under very suspicious circumstances?"
"What I'm hearing," Wayne said, taking another swig, "is that I was wrong. The fun isn't over."
"Many of these people shot one another," Waxillium said.
They all turned to him. He knelt beside another body, inspecting the way it had fallen, then looked up toward some bullet holes in the wall. Being a lawman, particularly out in the roughs, had required Waxillium to teach himself a wide variety of skills. He was part detective, part enforcer, part leader, part scientist. Maracy had read a dozen different profiles of him by various scholars, all investigating the mindset of a man who was becoming a living legend.
"What do you mean, Lord Ladrin?"
Aradel asked.
"The fight here involved multiple parties," Waxillium said, pointing. "If this was an unexpected hit by someone external, and Lady Combs is right, that would have made the most sense, one would expect the victims to have died from a barrage fired by the enemy who burst in. The corpses don't tell that story. This was a melee. Chaos. Random people firing at one another. I think it began when someone started shooting from the middle of the group outward."
"So it was one of the attendees who began it," Aradel said.
"Maybe," Waxillium said. "One can only tell so much from the fall of the bodies, the sprays of blood. But something is odd here. Very odd."
"Were they all shot?"
"No, strangely. A few of the attendees were killed by a knife in the back."
"Have you identified everyone in the room?" Waxillium asked.
"Most of them," Aradel said. "We wanted to avoid moving them too much."
"Let me see Lord Winsting," Waxillium said, standing, his mist coat rustling.
Aradel nodded to a young constable, and she led them out of the ballroom through a doorway. Some kind of secret passage? The musty stairwell beyond was narrow enough to force them to walk single file, the constable at the front carrying a lamp.
"Miss Combs," Waxillium said softly, "what do your statistics tell you about this kind of violence?"
"Oh, so we're using last names now, are we?" "Very little. I can count on the fingers of one hand the number of times something like this has happened. The first place I'd look is for connections between the people killed. Were they all in smuggling, Captain Aradel?"
"No," he said from behind. "Some smugglers, some extortionists, some gambling tycoons."
"So it's not a specific attempt to consolidate power in a certain type of criminal activity," Maracy said, her voice echoing in the damp stone stairwell. "We need to find the connection. What made these specific people targets? The one most likely behind it is dead."
"Lord Winsting," Waxillium said. "You're saying he lured them here, planned an execution, and it went wrong?"
"It's one theory."
"He ain't that kind of slime," Wayne said from near the end of the line.
"You know of Winsting?"
Maracy asked, looking over her shoulder.
"Not specifically, no," Wayne said. "But he was a politician. Politician slime is different from regular slime."
"I find myself agreeing," Captain Aradel said, "though I wouldn't put it so colorfully. We knew that Winsting was crooked, but in the past he kept mostly to small-time schemes, selling cargo space to smugglers when it suited him, some shady real estate deals here and there, cash in exchange for political favors mostly. Recently, rumors started that he was going to put his Senate vote up for sale. We were investigating, with no evidence so far. Either way, killing those willing to pay him would be like blasting your silver mine with dynamite to try finding gold.
They reached the bottom of the stairwell, where they found four more corpses. The guards, apparently, all killed with bullets to the head. Waxillium knelt.
Shot from behind, from the direction of the safe room, he whispered. All four in rapid succession.
Executed? Marcy asked. How did the killer get them to stand there and take it?
He didn't, Waxillium said. He moved too quickly for them to respond.
They're a chemist, Wayne said softly. Damn.
They were called steel runners, ferrochemists who could store up speed. They'd have to move slowly for a time, then could draw upon that reserve later. Waxillium looked up. Marcy saw something in his eyes, a hunger. He thought his uncle was involved. That was what he thought every time a metal-born committed crimes. Waxillium saw Suit's shadow over his shoulder each way he turned, a specter of a man whom Waxillium hadn't been able to stop. Suit still had Waxillium's sister, best as they could tell. Marcy didn't know much of it. Waxillium wouldn't talk about the details. He stood up, expression grim, and strode to the door behind the fallen men. He threw it open and entered, Marcy and Wayne close behind, to find a single corpse slumped in an easy chair at the center of the room. His throat had been slit. The blood on the front of his clothing was thick, dried like paint.
"Killed with some sort of long knife or small sword," Aradel said. "Even more strange, his tongue was cut out. We've sent for a surgeon to try to tell us more of the wound. Don't know why the killer didn't use a gun."
"Because the guards were still alive then," Waxillium said softly.
"What?"
"They let the killer pass," Waxillium said, looking at the door. "It was someone they trusted, perhaps one of their number. They let the murderer into the safe room."
"Maybe he was just moving very quickly to get past them," Marcy said.
"Maybe,"
Waxillium agreed. "But that door has to be unlocked from the inside, and it hasn't been forced. There's a peephole. Winsting let the murderer in, and he wouldn't have done that if the guards had been killed. He's sitting calmly in that chair. No struggle, just a quick slice from behind. Either he didn't know someone else was in here, or he trusted them. Judging by the way the guards fell outside, they were still focused on the steps, waiting for danger to come. They were still guarding this place. My gut says it was one of their own, someone they let pass who killed Winsting."
"Rusts," Aradel said softly. "But a ferrochemist? Are you sure?"
"Yeah," Wayne said from the doorway. "This wasn't a speed bubble. Can't shoot out of one of those, mate. These fellas were killed before one could turn about. Wax is right. Either this is a ferrochemist, or somebody figured out how to fire out of speed bubbles, which is something we'd really like to know how to do."
"Someone moving with ferrochemical speed explains the knife deaths up above," Waxillium said, standing. "A few swift executions in the chaos while everyone else was shooting. Quick and surgical. But the killer would be safe despite the firefight. Captain Aradel, I suggest you gather the names of Winsting's companions and staff. See if any corpses that should be here aren't. I'll look into the metalborn side. Steel runners aren't common, even as ferrochemists go."
"And the press?" Marcy asked.
Waxillium looked to Aradel, who shrugged.
"I can't keep a lid on this, Lord Ladrian," Aradel said. "Not with so many people involved. It's going to get out."
"Let it," Waxillium said with a sigh. "But I can't help feeling that's the point of all this."
"Excuse me," Wayne said. "I thought the point was killing folks."
"Lots of folks, Wayne," Waxillium said. "A shift in the power in the city. Were those upstairs the main target? Or was this an attack on the governor himself? A sideways strike upon his house? A message of some sort? Sent to tell Governor Innate that even he is not beyond their reach?"
He tipped Winsting's head back, looking at the gouged-out mouth. Marcy looked away.
"They removed the tongue," Waxillium whispered.
"Why? What are you up to, Uncle?"
"Excuse me?" Ardell asked. "Nothing," Waxillium said, dropping the head back to its slumped position. "I have to go sit for a portrait. I assume you'll be willing to send me a report once you've detailed all of this?"
"I can do that,"
Ardell said. "Good," Waxillium said, walking toward the door. "Oh, and Captain?"
"Yes, Lord Ladrian?"
"Prepare for a storm. This wasn't done quietly. It was done to be noticed. This was a challenge. Whoever did this isn't likely to stop here."
Part 2 5 Wayne tugged on his lucky hat. It was a coachman's hat, something like a wide-brimmed bowler, only one that didn't have 3 ounces of fancy shoved up its backside. He nodded to himself in his mirror, then wiped his nose. Sniffles. He'd started storing up health the day before, just after finding all those corpses. He already had a nice cushion of healing he could draw upon, tucked away in his metal-mined bracers. He hadn't needed much lately, and always spent days when he had a hangover, as sickly as he could manage, since he was going to have an awful time of it anyway. But the way things smelled, with all those important folk dead, warned him. He'd soon need some healing. Best to expand that cushion as he could. He went light at it today, though, because it was today, a day when he was going to need some luck. He was tempted to call it the worst day of his life, but that would certainly be an exaggeration. The worst day of his life would be the one when he died. "Might die today, though," he thought, looping on his belt and slipping his dueling canes into their straps, then wiping his nose again. "Can't be certain yet." Every man had to die. He'd always found it odd that so many died when they were old, as logic said that was the point in their lives when they'd had the most practice not dying. He wandered out of his room in Wax's mansion, idly noticing the scent of morning bread coming from the kitchens. He appreciated the room, though he really only stayed because of the free food. Well, that, and because of Wax. The man needed company to keep him from going more strange. Wayne wandered down a carpeted corridor that smelled of polished wood and servants who had too much time. The mansion was nice, but really, a man shouldn't live in a place that was so big. It just reminded him how small he was. Give Wayne nice, cramped quarters and he'd be happier. That way he'd feel like a king, with so much stuff, it crowded him. He hesitated outside the door to Wax's study. What was that sitting on the stand beside the doorway? A new candelabra, pure gold, with a white lace doily underneath. Exactly what Wayne needed. He fished in his pocket. Rich people didn't make sense at all. That candelabra was probably worth a fortune, and Wax just left it lying around. Wayne fished in his other pocket, looking for something good to trade, and came out with a pocket watch. Ah, that, he thought, shaking it and hearing the pieces rattle inside. How long since this thing actually told time? He picked up the candelabra, pocketed the doily underneath, then put the candelabra back in place with the pocket watch hanging from it. Seemed like a fair trade. Been needing a new handkerchief, he thought, blowing his nose into it, then pushed open the door and wandered in. Wax stood before an easel, looking at the large artist's sketch pad he had filled with intricate plans.
Up all night, were you?
Wayne asked with a yawn.
Rusts, Ban. You make it hard to loaf about properly.
I don't see what my insomnia has to do with your laziness, Wayne.
Makes me look bad, Saul, Wayne said, looking over Wax's shoulder. Proper loafing requires company. One man lying about is being idle. 2 men lying about is a lunch break.
Wax shook his head, walking over to look at some broadsheets. Wayne leaned in, inspecting Wax's paper. It held long lists of ideas, some connected by arrows, with a sketch of the way the bodies had fallen in both the ballroom and the safe room.
"What's all this, then?" Wayne asked,
picking up a pencil and drawing a little stick figure with a gun shooting at all the dead bodies. His hand trembled as he drew the stick gun, but otherwise it was a right good stick figure. "Proof to me that a steel runner is involved," Wax said. "Look at the pattern of deaths in the ballroom. Four of the most powerful people in the room were killed with the same gun, and they were the only ones up there killed by that weapon. But it's the same one that killed the guards outside the safe room. I bet those four above were shot first, dead in an eye blink, so fast that it sounded like a single long shot. Thing is, judging by the wounds, each shot came from a different location." Wayne didn't know a lot about guns, seeing as how he couldn't try to use one without his arm doing an impersonation of a carriage on a bumpy road. But Wax was probably right. Wayne moved down to start sketching some stick figures of topless women in the center of the picture, but Wax stepped over and plucked the pencil from his fingers.
"What's that?"
Wayne asked, tapping the center of the sketch pad where Wax had drawn a bunch of straight lines. "The pattern the killer used baffles me," Wax said. "The four people in the party he shot, they all fell while in random conversations. Look how they were lying. Everyone else who died was part of the larger shootout, but these four? They died while the party was still going on. But why did he shoot them from different directions? See, best I can guess, he fired first here, killing Lady Lenton. Her dropped drink was stomped on many times over the next few minutes. But then the killer used his speed to move quickly over here and fire in another direction. Then he moved again and again. Why four shots from different places? Who was standing where he shot? The people he killed, obviously. No, I mean, who was standing near him when he fired his gun? Not who did he shoot, but who was he near when he shot?"
"Ah," Wax said.
"Yep. Looks to me like he was trying to set them all off,"
Wayne said, sniffling.
"Get everyone in the room shooting at each other. See? It's like how to start a bar fight. You throw a bottle at some fellow and then turn to the person next to you and cry out, 'Hey, why'd you throw that bottle at that nice fellow? Rusty looks big. And now he's coming for you and—'"
"I understand the concept," Wax said dryly. He tapped the drawing pad. "You might have something."
"It's not catching."
Wax smiled, writing some notes on the side of the pad.
"So the killer wanted to sow chaos. He started a firefight by bouncing around the room, making it look like various parties were attacking one another. They would already have been tense, suspicious of one another."
"Yep. I'm a genius."
"You just recognize this because the killer was making others do his work for him, which is an expertise of yours."
"As I said, genius. So, how are you going to find him?"
"Well, I was thinking of sending you to the village to—"
"Not today,"
Wayne said. Wax turned to him, raising his eyebrows.
"It's the first of the month," Wayne said.
"Ah, I had forgotten. You don't need to go every month."
"I do."
Wax studied him, as if waiting for a further comment or wisecrack. Wayne said nothing. This was actually serious. Slowly, Wax nodded.
"I see. Then why haven't you left yet?"
"Well, you know," Wayne said, "it's like I often say.
Greet every morning with a smile, that way it won't know what you're planning to do to it."
"No, not that one."
"Until you know it ain't true, treat every woman like she has an older brother what is stronger than you are?"
"No, not—" "Wait, I said that?"
"Yes," Wax said, turning back to his notes. "It was a very chivalrous moment for you."
"Rosts, I should really write these things down."
"I believe that is another thing you often say," Wax made a notation. "Unfortunately, you'd first have to learn how to write."
"Now that's unfair,"
Wayne said, walking over to Wax's desk and poking around in his drawers.
"I can write. I know four whole letters, and one's not even in my name."
Wax smiled.
"Are you going to tell me what you always say?"
Wayne found a bottle in the bottom drawer and lifted it up, dropping in the lace he'd taken from outside as a replacement.
"If you're going to have to do something awful, stop by Wax's room and trade for some of his rum first."
"I don't believe you've ever said that."
"I just did."
Wayne took a gulp of the rum.
"I—"
Wax frowned. "I have no response to that." He sighed, setting down his pencil. However, since you're going to be indisposed, then I suppose I will have to go visit the village.
Sorry. I know you hate that place.
I will survive, Wax said, grimacing.
Want a piece of advice?
From you? Probably not. But please feel free.
You should stop by Wax's room before you go, Wayne said, trailing out toward the door, and pinch some of his rum. The rum you just pocketed?
Wayne hesitated, then took the rum out of his pocket.
Aw, mate, sorry. Tough for you.
He shook his head. Poor fellow. He pulled the door closed behind him, took a pull on the rum, and continued on his way down the stairs and out of the mansion. Marcy tugged at the collar of her jacket, glad for the seaborne wind that blew across her. It could get warm in her uniform, a proper one today, with a buttoned white blouse and brown skirt to match the brown coat. Next to her, the newsman wasn't so thankful for the wind. He cursed, throwing a heavy piece of iron, it looked like a piece of an old axle, onto his stack of broadsheets. On the street, the traffic slowed in a moment of congestion. Motor car drivers and coachmen yelled at one another.
"Ruined brake, that Tim Vashon," the newsman grumbled, looking at the traffic. "And his machines."
"It's hardly his fault,"
Marcy said, digging into her pocketbook.
"It is," the newsman said. "Motors were fine, nothing wrong with them for driving in the country or on a summer afternoon. But they're cheap enough now, everyone has to have one of the rusting things. A man can't take his horse 2 blocks without being run down 6 times."
Marcy exchanged coins for a broadsheet. The yelling subsided as the traffic clot loosened, horses and machines once again flowing across the cobbles. She raised the broadsheet, scanning above the fold for stories.
"Say," the newsman said, "weren't you just here?"
"I needed the afternoon edition,"
Marcy said absently, walking away. "Cry of outrage in the streets," the headline read. "A cry like that of twisting metal sounds through Ellendale as people take to the streets, outraged by government corruption. 1 week after the governor's veto of Bill 775, the so-called Workers' Rights Manifesto, his brother Winston Innate has been found dead after an apparent dealing with known criminals. Winston was killed in his mansion, perhaps a casualty of constable action against these criminal elements. Among the fallen is the notorious Dowser Moline, long suspected of running ore smuggling operations into the city, undercutting the work of honest men. The constables admit no culpability for the deaths, but suspicions about the mysterious circumstances have led to a general outcry." Marcy reached into her handbag and took out the morning edition of the same paper. "Mystery at Lord Winston's mansion," the headline read. "Constables have disclosed that Lord Winston, brother of the governor, was found dead in his mansion home last night. Little is known of the mysterious circumstances of the death, though several members of high society are rumored to have been present." Every other story in the paper was the same in both editions, save for one report on the floods in the east, which had an extra line updating casualty estimates. The Winston story had nudged 2 others off the page, in part because of the size of its headline. The Ellendale Daily was hardly the most reputable news source in the basin, but it did know its market. News stories that people agreed with, or were scared by, sold the most copies. Marcy hesitated on the steps of the 4th Octant precinct of the constabulary. People flowed on the sidewalks, bustling, anxious, heads down. Others loitered nearby, men in the dark jackets of teamsters, hands shoved in pockets, eyes shaded by peaked hats.
"Out of work," Marcy thought. "Too many idle men out of work."
Motor cars and electric lights were changing life in Ellendale so quickly it seemed that the common man had no hope of keeping up. Men whose families had worked for 3 generations in the same job suddenly found themselves unemployed. And with the labor disputes at the steel mills... The governor had recently given political speeches to these men, making promises. More coach lines to compete with rail lines, going places the railroad could not. Higher tariffs on imports from Bilming. Empty promises, mostly, but men losing hope clung to such promises. Winston's death could dash those promises. How would people react if they began to wonder if the governor, Replar Innate, was as corrupt as his brother?
A fire is kindling in the city, Maracy thought.
She could almost feel the heat coming off the page of the broadsheet in her hands. She turned and entered the constabulary offices, worrying that Lord Winsting might actually do more harm to Elendel dead than he had alive, which was saying something. Wax climbed out of the carriage, nodding to his coachman and indicating that the man should continue on home rather than wait for his master. Wax pulled on his aluminum-lined hat, broad-brimmed, Ruff's style, matching his duster, though he wore a fine shirt and cravat underneath. The hat and mist coat made him stand out like a man who had brought a shotgun to a knife fight. Workers passed in suspenders and caps, bankers in vests and monocles, constables in helms or bowlers and militaristic coats. No Ruff's hats. Maybe Wayne was right about that. He never would shut up about the importance of a hat. Wax took a deep breath, then stepped into the village. It had probably once been just an ordinary city street, a wide one, but still just a street. That was before the trees. They sprouted here, pushing cobblestones aside, creating a dense canopy that ran the length of the thoroughfare. It was a place that felt like it shouldn't be. No mere park, this was a forest, uncultivated and unmanicured, fresh and primal. You couldn't bring a carriage or motor into the village, even without the trees. The ground would be too rough now, rolling and uneven. The buildings along the street had been engulfed and became the property of the village. He couldn't help wondering if this was what all of Elendel would be like without the hand of men. Harmony had made the basin ferociously fecund. Men didn't farm here so much as fight to harvest quickly enough. Wax strode forward, arrayed as if for battle. Vindication and his Sterion at his hips, short-barreled shotgun in its holster on his thigh, metal burning inside of him. He pulled the brim of his hat low and entered another world. Children wearing simple white smocks played among the trees. Older youths wore the Tinningdar, the terrace robe marked with a V pattern running down the front. These looked up from the steps of buildings to watch him pass. The air smelled soft here. Soft air. A stupid metaphor, and yet there it was. That smell reminded him of his mother. Whispers rose around Wax like spring shoots. He kept his eyes forward, trudging across the too springy ground. There were no gates into or out of the village, yet you couldn't enter or leave without being identified. Indeed, moments after his entry, a young woman with streaming golden hair was sent running ahead of him to bear news of his arrival. They've found peace for themselves here, Wax thought. They've made peace for themselves. You shouldn't resent them so. After a short walk, he emerged from a stand of trees to find three terracemen waiting for him, arms folded, all wearing the robes of brutes, ferrochemists, who could increase their strength. Their features were varied enough that one wouldn't have pegged them as relatives. Two had the height that was often the terrace heritage, and one had skin that was darker. Some of the originators from ancient terrace had been dark of skin. Wax's own tan probably came from that lineage. None of the men here had the elongated features seen in the ancient paintings. That was a thing of mythology.
"What is it you need, outsider?" one of the men said.
"I want to speak with the Synod," Wax said.
"Are you a constable?"
the man said, looking Wax up and down. Children peeked out from behind nearby trees, watching him.
"Of a sort," Wax said. "The terrorists police themselves," another of the men said. "We have an arrangement."
"I'm aware of the compact," Wax said. "I just need to speak to the Synod, or at least Elder Vwafendal."
"You shouldn't be here, lawman," the lead terraceman said.
"It's all right, Razal,"
a tired voice said from the shadows of a nearby tree. The three terracemen turned, then quickly bowed as an old terrace woman approached.
Stately and white-haired, she had darker skin than Wax and walked with a cane she didn't need. The woman, Vafendal, studied Wax. He found himself sweating. Rizal, still bowing, spoke with a stubborn tone.
"We tried to send him away, Elder."
"He has a right to be here,"
Vafendal said.
"He has as much Terrace blood as you do. More than most."
The Terrace man brute started, then rose from his bow, peering again at Wax.
"You don't mean..."
"Yes," Vafendal said, looking very tired. "This is he, my grandson."
Wayne tipped the rum bottle up and teased the last few drops out into his mouth. Then he tucked the bottle into his coat pocket. It was a good bottle. He should be able to trade it for something. He hopped off the canal boat, giving a wave to Red, the boatman. Nice chap. He would let Wayne bum rides in exchange for a story. Wayne spat a coin out of his mouth. He'd been keeping it in his cheek, and flipped it to Red. Red caught the coin.
"Why is this wet? Were you sucking on it? Alamancers can't push on my coin if it's in my mouth,"
Wayne called.
"You're drunk, Wayne,"
Red said with a laugh, shoving off from the dock with his pole.
"Not nearly drunk enough,"
Wayne called back.
"That cheapskate Wax didn't even have the decency to stock a full bottle."
Red turned the canal boat, pulling it out into the waters, wind rippling his cloak. Wayne walked away from the post marking the canal-side mooring and was faced with the most intimidating sight a fellow could see. The Ellendel University. It was time for Wayne's three tests. He reached for the rum, then remembered, a little foggily, that he'd finished it all.
"Rust and ruin," he muttered.
Perhaps he shouldn't have downed the whole thing. Then again, it made his sniffles easy to ignore. When he was properly smashed, he could take a punch or two to the face and not even feel it. There was a kind of invincibility to that. A stupid kind, but Wayne wasn't a picky man. He made his way up to the university gates, hands stuffed in his coat pockets. The etched letters over the top proclaimed in high imperial, "Wuzzing the always of wanting of knowing." Deep words. He'd heard them interpreted as, "The eternal desire of a hungry soul is knowledge." When Wayne's soul was hungry, he settled for scones. But this place was full of smart kids, and they were a strange sort. Two men in black coats leaned casually against the gates. Wayne hesitated. So they were watching for him out front this time, were they? The first of his three trials was upon him. Rusting wonderful. Well, after the nature of any great hero from the stories, he was going to do his best to avoid this particular trial. Wayne ducked to the side before the two men could spot him, then followed the wall. The university was surrounded by the thing, like it was some kind of bunker. Were they afraid all their knowledge would leak out, like water from a swimmer's ears? Wayne craned his neck, looking for a way in. They'd bricked up the broken part he'd used last time. And the tree he'd climbed that other time had been cut down. Drat on them for that. He decided to follow another great tradition of heroes facing trials. He went looking for a way to cheat. He found Dims on a nearby corner. The young man wore a bowler hat and a bow tie, but a shirt that had the sleeves ripped off. He was head of one of the more important street gangs in the area, but never stabbed people too badly when he mugged them, and was polite with the people he extorted. He was practically a model citizen.
"Hello, Dims," Wayne said.
Dims eyed him.
"You a conner today, Wayne?"
"Nope."
"Ah, good," Dims said, settling down on the steps.
He took something out of his pocket, a little metal container.
"Here now," Wayne said, wiping his nose. "What's that?"
"Gum."
"Gum?"
"Yeah, you chew it."
Dims offered him a piece of the stuff. It was rolled into a ball, soft to the touch and powdered on the outside. Wayne eyed the lad, but decided to try it. He chewed for a moment.
"Good flavor," he said,
then swallowed. Dims laughed.
You don't swallow it, Wayne. You just chew.
What's the fun of that?
It feels good.
He tossed Wayne another ball. Wayne popped it into his mouth.
How are things, Wayne said, with you and the cobblers?
The cobblers were the rival gang in the area. Dims and his fellows went about with their sleeves torn. The cobblers wore no shoes. It apparently made perfect sense to the youths of the street, many of whom were the children of the houseless. Wayne liked to keep an eye on them. They were good lads. He'd been like them once. Then life had steered him wrong. Boys like this, they could use someone to point them in the right direction.
Oh, you know, Dims said. Some back, some forth.
There won't be trouble now, will there?
Wayne asked.
I thought you said you wasn't no Connor today. I ain't,
Wayne said, slipping, by instinct, into a dialect more like that of Dims.
I'm asking as a friend, Dims.
Dims scowled, looking away, but his muttered response was genuine.
We ain't stupid, Wayne. We'll keep our heads. You know we will.
Good.
Dims glanced back at him as Wayne settled down.
You bring that money you owe me?
I owe you money?
Wayne asked.
From cards, Dims said. 2 weeks back. Rusts, Wayne, are you drunk? It ain't even noon yet.
I ain't drunk,
Wayne said, sniffling.
I'm investigating alternative states of sobriety. How much do I owe you?
Dims paused.
20.
Ah, see,
Wayne said, digging in his pocket.
I distinctly remember borrowing 5 off you.
He held up a note. It was a 50. Dims raised an eyebrow.
You want something from me, I'm guessing.
I need into the university.
The gates are open, Dims said.
Can't go through the front. They know me.
Dims nodded. That sort of thing was a common complaint in his world.
What do you need from me?
A short time later, a man wearing Wayne's hat, coat, and dueling canes tried to pass through the front of the university. He saw the 2 men in black, then bolted as they chased after him. Wayne adjusted his spectacles, watching them go. He shook his head. Ruffians, trying to get into the university. Scandalous. He walked in through the gates, wearing a bow tie and carrying a load of books. Another of those men, who stood in a more hidden spot, watching his companions chase Dims, barely gave Wayne a glance. Spectacles. They were kind of like a hat for smart people. Wayne ditched the books inside the square, then walked past a fountain where a statue of a lady who wasn't properly clothed, he idled only a short time, and made his way toward Pashadon Hall, the girls' dormitory. The building looked an awful lot like a prison. 3 stories of small windows, stonework architecture, and iron gates that seemed to say, "Stay away, boys, if you value your nether parts." He pushed his way in the front doors, where he prepared himself for the second of his 3 tests. The Tyrant of Pashadon. She sat at her desk, a woman built like an ox, with a face to match. Her hair even curled like horns. She was a fixture of the university, or so Wayne had been told. Perhaps she had come with the chandeliers and sofas. She looked up from her desk in the entryway, then threw herself to her feet in challenge.
You!
Hello,
Wayne said.
How did you get past campus security?
I tossed them a ball,
Wayne said, tucking the spectacles into his pocket.
Most hounds love having something to chase.
The Tyrant rumbled around the side of her desk. It was like watching an ocean liner try to navigate city canals. She wore a tiny hat in an attempt at fashion. She liked to consider herself a part of Ellendale upper society, and she kind of was. In the same way that the blocks of granite that made up the steps to the governor's mansion were a part of civic government.
You,
she said, spearing Wayne in the chest with a finger.
I thought I told you not to come back.
I thought I ignored you.
Are you drunk?
She sniffed at his breath.
No,
Wayne said.
If I were drunk, you wouldn't look nearly so ugly.
She huffed, turning away.
I can't believe your audacity.
Really? Because I'm sure I've been this audacious before. Every month, in fact. So this seems a right believable thing for me to do.
I'm not letting you in. Not this time. You are a scoundrel.
Wayne sighed. Heroes and stories never had to fight the same beast twice. Seemed unfair he had to face this one each month.
Look, I just want to check in on her.
She is fine.
I have money, Wayne said, to give her.
You can leave it here. You distress the girl, miscreant.
Wayne stepped forward, taking the tyrant by the shoulder.
I didn't want to have to do this.
She looked at him. And to his surprise, she cracked her knuckles. Wow. He reached into his pocket quickly and pulled out a piece of pasteboard.
One ticket, Wayne said quickly. Admitting two people to the governor's spring dinner and policy speech occurring during a party at Lady Zobel's penthouse tonight. This here ticket lists no specific names. Anyone who has it can get in.
Her eyes widened.
Who'd you steal that from?
Please, Wayne said. It came delivered to my house.
Which was perfectly true. It was for Wax and Steris. But they were important enough folk that invitations sent to them had no names, so they could send an emissary if they wished. When it came to someone fancy like Wax, even getting their relative or friend to attend your party could be advantageous. The tyrant didn't count as either. But Wayne figured that Wax would be happy not to have to go to the blasted party anyway. Besides, Wayne had left a real nice-looking leaf he'd found in exchange. Rusting beautiful, that leaf was. The tyrant hesitated, so Wayne waved the ticket in front of her.
I guess, she said, I could let you in one last time. I'm not supposed to allow unrelated men into the visiting room, however.
I'm practically family, he said.
They made a big fuss about keeping the young women and the young men separated around here, which Wayne found odd. With all of these smart people around, wouldn't one of them have realized what boys and girls were supposed to do together? The tyrant let him pass into the visiting room, then sent one of the girls at the desk to run for Alejandra. Wayne sat down, but couldn't keep his feet from tapping. He'd been stripped of weapons, bribes, and even his own hat. He was practically naked, but he'd made it to the final test. Alejandra entered a few moments later. She'd brought backup with her in the form of two other young ladies about her age, just shy of 20.
Smart girl, Wayne thought, proud.
He rose.
Madame Penfor says you're drunk,
Alejandra said, remaining in the doorway. Wayne tapped his metal mind, drawing forth healing. In a moment, his body burned away its impurities and healed its wounds. It thought alcohol was a poison, which showed that a fellow couldn't always trust his own body, but today he didn't complain. It also washed away his sniffles for the moment, though those would return. It was hard to heal from diseases with a metal mind, for some reason. Either way, sobriety hit him like a brick to the chin. He inhaled deeply, feeling even more naked than before.
Oh, I just like to play with her,
Wayne said, all hint of slur gone from his voice, eyes focused. Alejandra studied him intently, then nodded. She did not enter the room.
I brought this month's money,
Wayne said, taking an envelope out and setting it on the low, glass-topped table beside him. He stood up straight, then shuffled from one foot to the other.
Is that really him?
One of the girls asked Alejandra.
They say he rides with Dawnshot, of the Ruffs.
It's him,
Alejandra said, eyes still on Wayne.
I don't want your money.
Your mama told me to bring it to you,
Wayne said.
You don't need to bring it in person.
I do,
Wayne said quietly. They stood in silence, neither party moving. Wayne finally cleared his throat.
How are your studies?
Are you treated well here? Is there anything you need?
Alejandra reached into her handbag and took out a large locket. She spread it open, displaying a strikingly distinct Ivanotype of a man with a wide mustache and a twinkle in his eyes. He had a long, friendly face, and his hair was thinning on top. Her father. She made Wayne look at it every time.
"Tell me what you did," she said.
That voice. It could have been the voice of winter itself.
"I don't... tell me!"
The third trial.
"I killed your daddy,"
Wayne said softly, looking at the picture. "I mugged him in an alley for his pocketbook. I shot a better man than me, and because of that I don't deserve to be alive."
"You know you aren't forgiven."
"I know."
"You will never be forgiven."
"I know."
"Then I'll take your blood money,"
Alejandra said.
"If you care to know, my studies go well. I am thinking of taking up the law."
Someday, he hoped he might be able to look into the girl's eyes and see emotion. Hatred, maybe. Something other than emptiness.
"Get out."
Wayne ducked his head and left. There should not have been a thatched log hut in the middle of Ellendale, and yet here it was. Wax stooped to enter, seeming to step backward in time hundreds of years. The air inside smelled of old leather and furs. The enormous fire pit in the middle would never be needed in Ellendale's mild weather. Today, a smaller fire had been constructed at its very center, and over it simmered a small kettle of hot water for tea. However, charred stones indicated that the entire fire pit was sometimes used. It, the furs, the ancient-style paintings on the wall, of winds and frozen rain, and tiny figures painted with simple strokes on slopes, were all fragments of a myth. Old Terrace, a legendary land of snow and ice, with white-furred beasts and spirits that haunted frozen storms. During the early days following the Catasandra, refugees from Terrace had written down memories of their homeland, as no keepers had remained. Wax settled down beside his grandmother's fire pit. Some said that old Terrace waited for this people, hidden somewhere in this new world of Harmony's design. To the faithful, it might as well have been paradise. A frozen, hostile paradise. Living in a land naturally lush with bounteous fruit, where little cultivation was required, could warp one's vision. Grandmother V settled down opposite him, but did not start the fire.
"Did you remove your guns before entering the village this time?"
"I did not," she snorted.
"So insolent. During your long absence, I often wondered if the roughs might temper you."
"They made me more stubborn, is all."
"A land of heat and death,"
Grandmother V said. She crinkled a handful of herbs, flakes dropping into a tea strainer above her cup. She poured steaming water over them, then placed the lid with a gnarled hand.
"Everything about you stinks of death, Asinthu."
"That isn't what my father named me."
"Your father didn't have the right. I would demand you remove your weapons, but it would be meaningless. You could kill with a coin, or with a button, or with this pot."
"Elemancy is not so evil as you make it out to be, Grandmother."
"Neither power is evil," she said. "It is mixing those powers that is dangerous. Your nature is not your fault, but I cannot help but see it as a sign. Another tyrant in our future, too powerful. It leads to death."
Sitting in this hut, the scent of Grandmother's tea, memories grabbed Wax by his collar and shoved him face first up against his past. A young man who had never been able to decide what he was. Allomancer, a ferrochemist, city lord, or humble terraceman. His father and uncle pushing him one way, his grandmother another. "A ferrochemist slaughtered people in the fourth octant last night, Grandmother," Wax said. "He was a steel runner. I know you track everyone in the city with ferrochemical blood. I need a list of names." Grandmother V swished around her tea.
You visited the village on what, a mere 3 occasions since your return to the city? Nearly 2 years, and you've made time for your grandmother only 2 before today.
Can you blame me, considering how these meetings usually go? To be blunt, Grandmother, I know how you feel about me, so why torture either of us?
You cling to your images of me from 2 decades ago, child. People change, even one such as I.
She sipped her tea, then added more herbs to the strainer and lowered it back into the water. She would not drink until it was right.
Not one such as you, it appears.
Trying to bait me, Grandmother?
No, I am better at insults than that. You haven't changed. You still don't know who you are.
An old argument. She'd said it to him both times they'd met during the last 2 years. I'm not going to start wearing terrace robes, speaking softly, quoting proverbs at people.
You will shoot them instead.
Wax took a deep breath. A mixture of scents lingered in the air. From the tea? Scents like that of freshly cut grass. His father's estates, sitting on the lawn, listening to his father and grandmother argue. Wax had lived here in the village for only a single year. It had been all his father had agreed to give. Even that had been surprising. Uncle Edwarn had wanted Wax and his sister to both stay away from the place. Before his official heir, the late Hinston Ladrian, had been born when Wax was 18, Edwarn had basically appropriated his brother's children and tried to raise them. Even still, it was hard to separate Wax's parents' will in his head from that of Edwarn. 1 year among these trees. Wax had been forbidden alomancy during his days in the village, but had learned something far greater. That criminals existed, even among the idyllic terrace. The only times I've truly known who I am, Wax said, looking up at his grandmother, meeting her eyes, are when I've put on the mist coat, strapped guns to my waist, and hunted down men gone rabid.
You should not be defined by what you do, but by what you are.
A man is what he does.
You came looking for a ferrochemist killer? You need only look in the mirror, child. If a man is what he does, think of what you've done.
I've never killed a man who didn't deserve it.
Can you be absolutely certain of that?
Reasonably. If I've made mistakes, I'll pay for them someday. You won't distract me, Grandmother. To fight is not against the terrace way. Harmony killed.
He slew beasts and monsters only. Never our own.
Wax breathed out. This again? Rusts, I should have forced Wayne to come here instead of me. He says she actually likes him. A new scent struck him. Crushed blossoms. In the darkness of that chamber, he imagined himself again standing among the trees of the terrace village, looking up at a broken window and feeling the bullet in his hand. And he smiled. Once that memory had brought him pain, the pain of isolation. Now he saw only a budding lawman, remembered the sense of purpose he'd felt. Wax stood up, grabbing his hat, mistcoat rustling. He almost wanted to believe that the scents to the room, the memories, were his grandmother's doing. Who knew what she put into that tea? I'm going to hunt down a murderer, Wax said. If I do it without your help and he kills again before I can stop him, you will be partially to blame. See how well you sleep at night then, Grandmother.
Will you kill him? She asked. Will you shoot for the chest when you could aim for the leg? People die around you. Do not deny it.
I don't, he said. A man should never pull a trigger unless he's willing to kill. And if the other fellow is armed, I'm going to aim for the chest. That way, when people do die around me, it's the right ones. Grandmother V stared at her teapot.
The one you're looking for, is named Idashwi, and she is not a man.
Steel Runner?
Yes. She is not a killer, but she is the only Steel Runner I know of who could possibly be involved in something like this. She vanished about a month ago, after acting very erratically. Claimed that she was being visited by the spirit of her dead brother.
Idashwi, he said. It was pronounced in the Terrace manner. The syllables felt thick in his mouth, another reminder of his days in the village. The Terrace language had been dead once, but Harmony's records included it, and many Terrace now learned to speak it in their youths.
I swear I know that name.
You did know her. Long ago,
Grandmother V said.
You were with her that night, actually, before.
Ah, yes. Slender, golden hair, shy, and didn't speak much. I didn't know she was a ferrochemist.
You don't even have the decency to look ashamed,
Grandmother V said. I'm not, Wax said. Hate me if you must, Grandmother, but coming to live with you changed my life, just as you always promised it would. I'm not going to be ashamed that the transformation wasn't the one you expected.
Just try to bring her back, Asinthu. She's not a killer. She's confused.
They all are, Wax said, stepping out of the hut. The three men from before stood outside, glaring at him with displeasure. Wax tipped his hat to them, dropped a coin, then launched himself into the air between two trees, passing their canopies and seeking the sky. Each time Maracy entered the precinct offices, she got a little thrill. It was the thrill of bucked expectations, of a future denied. Even though this room didn't look like she'd imagined, as the clerical and organizational center for the Octant's constables, it felt more like a business office than anything else. The mere fact that she was here excited her. This wasn't supposed to have been her life. She'd grown up reading stories of the roughs, of lawmen and villains. She'd dreamed of six guns and stagecoaches. She'd even taken up horseback riding and rifle shooting. And then, real life had intervened. She'd been born into privilege. Yes, she was illegitimate, but the generous stipend from her father had set her and her mother up in a fine home. Money for an education had been guaranteed for her. With that kind of promise, and with her mother's determination that Maracy should enter society and prove herself to her father, one did not choose a profession so lowly as that of a constable. Yet, here she was. It was wonderful. She passed through the room full of people at desks. Though a jail was attached to the building, it had its own entrance, and she rarely visited it. Many of the constables she passed on her way through the main chamber were the type who spent most of their days at a desk. Her own spot was a comfortable nook near Captain Aradel's office. His room felt like a closet inside, and Aradel rarely spent time there. Instead, he stalked through the main chamber like a prowling lion, always in motion. Maracy set her handbag on her desk next to a stack of last year's crime reports. In her spare time, she was trying to judge to what extent petty crimes in a region foretold greater ones. Better that than reading the politely angry letters from her mother, which lay underneath. She peeked into the captain's office and found his waistcoat thrown across his desk, right beside the pile of expense reports he was supposed to be initialing. She smiled and shook her head, dug his pocket watch out of his waistcoat, then went hunting. The offices were busy, but they didn't have the bustle of the prosecutor's offices. During her internship there, beneath Dias, everyone had always seemed so frantic. People worked all hours, and when a new case was posted, every junior solicitor in the room rushed over in a flurry of papers, coats, and skirts, craning to see who had posted the case and how many assistants they would be taking. The opportunities for prestige, and even wealth, had been bountiful, and yet she hadn't been able to shake the feeling that nobody was actually doing anything. Cases that could make a difference languished because they weren't high-profile enough, while anything under the patronage of a prominent lord or lady was seen to immediately. The rush had been less about fixing the city's problems and more about making certain the senior solicitors saw how much more eager you were than your colleagues. She'd probably still be there if she hadn't met Waxillium. She'd have done as her mother wanted, seeking validation through her child. Proof, perhaps, that she could have married Lord Harms, if it had been in the cards, despite her low birth. Marcy shook her head. She loved her mother, but the woman simply had too much time on her hands. The constable's offices were so different from the solicitor's. Here there was a true sense of purpose, but it was measured, even thoughtful. Constables leaned back in chairs and described evidence to other officers looking for help on a case. Junior corporals moved through the room, delivering cups of tea, fetching files, or running some other errand. The competition she'd felt among the solicitors barely existed here. Perhaps that was because there was little prestige and even less wealth to go around. She found Aradel with sleeves rolled up, one foot on a chair, bothering Lieutenant Cabarel.
No, Aradel said. I'm telling you, we need more men on the streets, near the pubs at nights, where the foundry workers congregate after the strike line breaks up. Don't bother guarding them during the day.
Cabarel nodded placidly, though she gave Marcy a roll of the eyes as she walked up. Aradel did tend to micromanage, but at least he was earnest. In Marcy's experience, they were almost all fond of him, eye rolls notwithstanding. She plucked a cup of tea off the plate of a passing corporal who was delivering them to the desks. He quickly moved on, eyes forward, but she could almost feel him glaring at her. Well, it wasn't her fault she'd landed this position and the rank of lieutenant without ever having to deliver tea. All right, she admitted to herself, sipping the tea and stepping up beside Aradel. Maybe there is a bit of competition around here.
You'll see this done, then? Aradel asked.
Of course, sir, Cabarel said.
She was one of the few in the place who treated Marcy with any measure of respect. Perhaps it was because they were both women. There were fewer women in the constabulary than among the solicitors. One might have guessed that the reason for this was that ladies weren't interested in the violence, but having done both jobs, Marcy felt she knew which profession was bloodier, and it wasn't the one where people carried guns.
Good, good, Aradel said. I have a debriefing with Captain Reddy in—he
patted at his pocket. Marcy held out his watch, which he grabbed and checked for the time.
15 minutes. Huh, more time than I expected. Where'd you get that tea, Combs?
Want me to have someone fetch you some? She asked.
No, I can do it.
He bustled off, and Marcy nodded to Cabarel, then hurried after him.
Sir, she said, have you seen the afternoon broadsheets?
He held out his hand, which she filled with paper. He held up the stack of broadsheets and almost ran over three different constables on his way to the stove and the tea.
Bad,
he muttered.
I'd hoped they'd spin this against us.
Us, sir?
Marcy asked, surprised.
Sure, he said. Nobleman dead, constables not giving the press details. This reads like they started to pin the death on the constables, but then changed their minds. By the end, the tone is far more outraged against Winsting than us.
And that's worse than outrage at us for a cover-up?
Far worse, Lieutenant, he said with a grimace, reaching for a cup. People are used to hating Connors. We're a magnet for it, a lightning rod. Better us than the governor.
Unless the governor deserves it, sir.
Dangerous words, Lieutenant, Aradel said,
filling his cup with steaming tea from the large urn kept warm atop the coal stove.
And likely inappropriate.
You know there are rumors that he's corrupt, Marcy said softly.
What I know is that we are civil servants, Aradel said. There are enough people out there with the mindset and the moral position to monitor the government. Our job is to keep the peace.
Marcy frowned, but said nothing. Governor Innate was corrupt. She was almost sure of it. There were too many coincidences, too many small oddities in his policy decisions. It wasn't by any means obvious, but trends were Marcy's specialty and her passion. It wasn't as if she'd wanted to discover that the leader of Ellendale was trading favors with the city's elite, but once she'd spotted the signs, she'd felt compelled to dig in. On her desk, carefully hidden under a stack of ordinary reports, was a ledger in which she'd assembled all the information. Nothing concrete, but the picture it drew was clear to her, even though she understood that it would look innocent to anyone else. Aradel studied her.
You disagree with my opinion, Lieutenant?
One doesn't change the world by avoiding the hard questions, sir.
Feel free to ask them, then. In your head, Lieutenant, and not out loud, particularly not to people outside the precinct. We can't have the men we work for thinking we are trying to undermine them.
Funny, sir, Marcy said. I thought we worked for the people of the city, not their leaders.
Aradel stopped, cup of steaming tea halfway to his lips.
Suppose I deserve that, he said,
then took a gulp, shaking his head. He didn't flinch at the heat. People in the office figured he'd seared his taste buds off years ago.
Let's go.
They wove through the room toward Aradel's office, passing Captain Reddy at his desk. The lanky man rose, but Aradel waved him down, pulling out his watch.
I still have 5 minutes until I have to deal with you, Reddy.
Marcy shot the captain an apologetic smile. She got a scowl in return.
Someday, she noted, I'm going to figure out why that man hates me.
Hmm? Aradel said.
Oh, you stole his job.
Marcy missed a step, stumbling into Lieutenant Alstrom's desk.
What?
She demanded, hurrying after Aradel.
Sir?
Reddy was going to be my assistant, Aradel said as they reached his office. Had a damn fine bid for the job. I was all but priced into hiring him, until I got your application.
Marcy blushed deeply.
Why would Reddy want to be your assistant, sir? He's a field constable, a senior detective.
Everyone has this idea that in order to move up, you need to spend more time in the office and less on the street, Aradel said. Stupid tradition, even if the other Octants follow it. I don't want my best men and women turning into desk slugs. I want the assistant position to be for nurturing someone fresh, who shows promise, rather than letting some practiced constable gather moss.
The realization made a lot of things lock into place for Marcy. The hostility she felt for many of the others wasn't just because she'd skipped the lower ranks. Many with noble titles did that. It was because they'd solidified behind Reddy, their friend, who'd been slighted.
So,
Marcy said, taking a deep breath and grasping for something to keep her from a panic.
You think I show promise, then?
Of course I do. Why would I have hired you otherwise?
Corporal Maindew walked by, saluting, and Aradel threw the wadded broadsheets into his face.
No saluting indoors, Maindew. You'll knock yourself unconscious slapping your forehead every time I walk past.
He glanced back at Marcy as Maindew mumbled an apology and rushed off.
There's something in you, Combs, Aradel told her. Not the gloss and glint of the application. I don't care about your grades or what those zinc tongues in the solicitor's office thought of you. The words you wrote about changing the city, they made sense. They impressed me.
Thank you for the praise, sir.
I'm not flattering you, Combs. It's just a fact.
He pointed toward the door.
That broadsheet said the governor was going to address the city later this afternoon. I'll bet the second Octant constables ask us for help managing the crowds. They always do. So I'm going to send a street detail. Go with them and listen. Then report back to me what Governor Innate says. And pay attention to how the crowd reacts.
Yes, sir,
Marcy said, stopping herself from saluting as she snatched her handbag and ran to follow the orders. Upper left quadrant of the broadsheet, The House Record. The Journal of Civilization, Society, and Culture. First of Doxel, number 342. Morning edition. Copyright, 342. Lassan Kalur and Daughters and Sons. Market opening. EBSE stocks, plus 0.5. Commodities, down 2.1. Gentleman Jack, in the City of Fountains, part 6.
The Sinister Soiree. I need not remind my astute readers of the precarious situation in which I was left at the end of last week's column, but for those of you whose heightened tastes have just now led them from the gutters of disgraceful journalism to the noble pages of the House Record, let me present a short recapitulation.